This is The Guardian.
Wenn man Leute fragt, was macht einen Investor aus, bekommt man oft diese Antworten. Investoren sind reich. Sie tragen teure Anzüge und haben Designertaschen. Sie waren Einserschüler und sind Mathe-Genies. Interessant, aber das stimmt so nicht ganz. Man muss weder reich noch Experte sein, um zu investieren. Mit iShares ETFs kannst du in Hunderte und Tausende von Unternehmen mit nur einem einfachen Schritt investieren. Schon ab einem Euro. Finde iShares bei deinem Broker oder deiner Bank und fang noch heute an, mit ETFs zu sparen. Kapitalanlagerisiko. Marketinginformation.
This week, the teenager who murdered three young girls in Southport pleaded guilty to the horrific attack. Not long after, Keir Starmer declared a public inquiry into how the state failed to prevent it.
This case is a sign. Britain now faces a new threat. Terrorism has changed.
So, is an inquiry the best way to stop another outrage like Southport? And how will the UK and the world deal with this?
We will drill, baby, drill.
As Donald Trump returns with a vengeance, Keir Starmer faces a big test on the global stage. So how should he play it? I'm John Harris and you're listening to Politics Week the UK for The Guardian. The government has announced an inquiry into how the state failed to prevent the murder of three young girls in Southport and why no action was taken when the attacker was referred three times to the Prevent programme, which is designed to deal with cases of so-called radicalisation. There's a sense in the failures around this case of an overstretched system trying to deal with threats that, it's fair to say, are only going to get worse. Rashad Ali joins me now. He's a senior fellow at the Institute for Strategic Dialogue and a counter-terrorism practitioner who's worked on de-radicalisation programmes and advised the government. Rashad, thank you for being here.
Thank you for inviting me on.
It's Wednesday afternoon as we speak, and besides the public inquiry, the government has announced a wave of measures to try and stop attacks like this. They include a crackdown on knife sales and pressure on social media firms to remove violent content. But let me start by asking you this. We now know that Prevent failed to step in three times in this case. Why do you think that was?
When it comes to ensuring that the Prevent strategy is implemented properly, there's probably a number of places where issues can go wrong.
Okay.
And this is usually the human element of decision making regarding things like how do they perceive someone to be a real threat, or how do they perceive someone to be on the process of being radicalized and we need to intervene and do something about it.
So be more specific. A lot is made of the fact that Axel Rudakabana was acting alone, didn't necessarily fit any preordained template, right? Is that the kind of thing that would have got in the way of the Prevent program working effectively in this case?
So I think at various stages, the way the program works is somebody may find something disconcerting or make an assessment, say, hold on a second, this looks like it's concerning. At that point, they'll make a referral, and that referral will be based on the information that's given. Police will have a look and see if there's any intelligence available about the individual. They will then make an assessment and say, is this person a concern? At that stage, there'll be a decision made by an individual or a group to say, this individual does not appear to be going down a line of activity which is going to end up in terrorism.
And are there finely balanced judgments that presumably it's just in their nature that they can often end up in the wrong decision being made and someone being left alone?
If you look at this as a spectrum, I mean, the danger is that individuals who show signs of political disgruntlement, grievances, conservative religious ideology or religious persuasion, a politics that maybe we do not find, you know, agreeable to our sensibilities. None of those in themselves are actually reasons for concern. You know, living in a liberal democracy, the idea is that people can have wacky, wonderful and extreme ideas. But it's when those ideas are on a trajectory towards embracing terrorist ideas, the justifications for violence, that we would seek to intervene to stop that individual undertaking such an act. And I guess here is the issue. The issue becomes, where do you determine somebody is on a pathway towards undertaking a terrorist act, and where are they just merely very, very disgruntled, very, very angry, understandably annoyed maybe at the politics that we see around us, both locally and globally?
Yeah, presumably there are lots, if not ever increasing numbers of those people, and therefore The ones that may or may not be on a path to terrorist activity are quite hard to spot because of sheer numbers. Here's a question. If you were to redesign the PREVENT program, which, as we both know, has been criticised a lot down the years, broadly speaking, what would it look like?
So it's a really good question. If we were to redesign the program from scratch, what would we do? And I always find it interesting because it's not the first time this question's asked. Whenever you get any group of people, they're very critical of the PREVENT strategy, and you ask them to sit back and design a program, they'll say things like, we need one which brings the community. We need one which brings mainstream services to help people with education, with their social services, whether it's ones that work together. We don't want to criminalize the individual. And what you end up designing is something that is very, very similar to what we have as the PREVENT program. It's a program of referral. You get mainstream services together. It becomes statutory upon them to do something to help the individual. You'll get community figures involved. You'll get social workers involved. And then you'll steer and develop a plan for that individual to help them move away from being radicalized into terrorism.
If you have been or you're on the way to being radicalized, the idea that the state will offer you help, right, in the cause of being de-radicalized will be anathema to you, right? I mean, that's exactly what you position yourself against. And yet, as I understand it, de-radicalization can and does work, right? Can you just tell me a bit from your experience about how de-radicalization works in practice?
Absolutely. I think that the truth is the start point of any engagement is negative because you're starting to talk to somebody as on behalf of the broader society. A society which they've rejected.
Right.
You know, a state authority which they see as being part of the problem. And what you have to then do is be able to create a relationship where there's an element of trust, that they know you're on their side. And that comes fundamentally from your focus being the interests of the individual you're talking to. You're there in order to help that individual.
There must be plenty of occasions, though, where they say, I'm not into this. This is exactly what I've set myself against and I'm out of here.
So this is the reality of this, is that essentially if you're dealing with a voluntary program, then there's going to be times when people may be referred and they don't want to take part,
right?
Which is rare. In almost 90% of the time I've engaged with people, they are willing to talk to you, they're willing to engage with you, and they're willing to have that conversation.
You yourself were once an Islamist radical, right?
Yeah. So as a teenager growing up, I was someone that kind of grew up around times when there was a genocide happening in Europe, you know, happening to Bosnians. And it seemed that no government really cared. And so there was lots of reasons to be radicalized as I was growing up in terms of as a Muslim rejected by society.
Yeah.
The radical call of Islamists who wanted a caliphate to expand and spread Islam to all the Muslim world and protect Muslims with this in Palestine, Kashmir, Bosnia. All of those touch points, all of those grievances were very, very strong. And as a simple kid, one state, one nation, one solution to all problems, it's quite attractive.
So when you meet or you hear about someone who's been radicalized, even to the point of committing terrorist acts, is there a part of you that feels a sort of empathy?
In terms of understanding this, we've got to separate between how people feel, why they may feel angry, and why they may be desperate for a radical solution. That is something I think human beings looking at the world today, whether it's looking at what's happening with, you know, Ukraine and Russia, when they look at what's happening with Israel, Palestine, you know, and the problems there, I think it's easy to empathize with why people feel there's a need for a radical change in the world today. What we should separate that from is the totalitarian and authoritarian solution and the actions of extreme ideology to bring them about.
The idea that horror and terror is a means to an end, right? I mean, that's it. That's one of the central things you're trying to get out of the way, right?
Sure. So there's two things. There's the be able to understand how and why somebody is radicalized. And secondly, the connective tissue, the ideology itself. That should be something that we understand, but not empathize and justify. And there are two different things there. Empathy with the individual is different to justifying the ideology.
What other structures, schemes, whatever, are in place to stop young people in the future from carrying out what Keir Starmer has called acts of extreme violence perpetrated by loners, misfits, and young men? I ask you that mainly because I think it's fair to say we both know there's going to be more of these cases. Because this is about the world we now live in, right? The idea that people in solitude, in their bedrooms, log on, and then off they go. And suddenly they're exposed to and immersed in things that they just weren't that accessible 30 or 40 years ago, right? So what else are the authorities, as you understand it, doing to act on that particular problem specifically?
So I think two maybe contradictory things. First of all, I don't believe that the nature of the major threats that we face in terrorism are solely from loners of that nature. The type of individuals that get caught up within terrorist acts, especially ones radicalized by Islamist ideology and far-right ideology, actually cross the entire spectrum of people, not just loners. There right. is a very specific group of individuals who, if you like, they don't necessarily embrace Islamist ideology, far-right ideology, or leftist extremism. It's a hodgepodge of different grievances, different political ideologies. And actually, those individuals are harder to capture because they're not necessarily radicalized by one ideology. They are on the fringes of violence and radical influences. And so they end up engaging in violent acts, which are otherwise not rationalizable in any possible way.
Right, right.
And that's the challenge, really. And here, the stresses on our system are big issues, whether it's mental health services, whether it's individual support for youth services, whether it's being able to ensure that actually those that fall through the system are captured by our state. And I think those are systemic failures that we are really, really lacking in dealing with. If we are saying we're serious about extremism and radicalization, then yes, we need to be able to say, here are the resources for people that are engaging with this, whether at a community level, whether at the individual level, or whether at the level of mainstream services to deal with this problem. Otherwise, it's just lip service and politics.
That's such a fascinating point, that. And it's such a modern phenomenon, isn't it? The idea that there are people on their own who end up with these very sort of singular combinations of ideologies, right? And maybe fall for the idea of violence for its own sake and so on in a way that's unique to them. And therefore, they're all the harder to trace and to follow and so on. That's a really, really brilliant point. Right. Do you think the government and the authorities should have been more transparent about their knowledge and their monitoring of Axel Ruder Cabana? They've come in for a lot of criticism about that point. They should have told the public more.
I think, let's be very clear, we have laws against public reporting of arrests for a very, very good reason. And that reason is to stop prejudicing the judiciary. There's laws that say we should be careful about what we discuss in public in order to not prejudice the case. The people that are saying this know full well what they're calling for is contra legislation in the UK, is damaging against the interests of the people who have, the victims who've had this horrendous crime perpetrated against them, because they want to make sure there is not any reason why this case cannot go to court. The people doing this are not just playing a horrendous game in terms of the politics, but the consequences were providing the disinformation required for the far right to undertake the horrendous acts that we saw.
You're talking about the riots that followed the murders.
The riots, the violence, the, you know, attacks on individuals, the racist attacks on, you know, black individuals who happened to be there, Muslim communities that were attacked, threats that mosques faced. All of this happened as a result of the mainstreaming of that narrative through politicians that know full well what they're doing is on the verge of breaking the law, if not absolutely breaking the law.
Rashad, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure. Thank you very much. And it's a privilege to be on.
I'm now joined by The Guardian's Kieran Stacey. Hi, Kieran.
Hey, John.
Well, let's carry on talking about Southport and this public inquiry, which is going to happen. Keir Starmer obviously smelt danger here. He jumped in on Tuesday morning to announce that a public inquiry would be happening. Here's a question about the sort of hard-boiled politics of all this. In other words, the political calculation at work. We both know that on grooming gangs, that became the sort of central demand of the government's opponents. A lot of that is still sort of ricocheting around. So do you think there's therefore a sensitivity, a sort of fear of the political discourse about public inquiries, and therefore they had to act all the quicker here and get on top of this fast?
Yeah, I mean, it's not just about public inquiries, but it's about any kind of scandal which involves criminality, particularly from people of a particular ethnic minority.
Yeah.
And that's essentially what we're talking about. And that's what links the two cases together.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Keir Starmer and the people around him realised that these can be weaponised by people incredibly effectively, not just on the far right, but on the centre right as well, and used against the Labour government. And Keir Starmer is doubly vulnerable to this because not only is he kind of centre-left prime minister, but of course he was former DPP who was running the CPS during the time when some of these things were happening. So he, I think, rightly recognized that he had a political problem when it came to Southport and had to get out in front of it.
He would say, of course, in public at least, that political calculations have nothing to do with this, and it's about the substantial issues that a public inquiry needs to look at, right?
He might do. if he wasn't being very honest.
It can be about, but it can be about both, right? You can't have a public inquiry about nothing. Clearly, there are issues that need to be looked at here looks like very serious failure, right?
No. That's true. I mean, there are things that need to be looked into, whether it needs a public inquiry or not. I'm deeply cynical about public inquiries generally. I think they take up lots of time, and they generally are used as a way for the government to be able to deflect questions from journalists, just to point to a public inquiry and say, well, sorry, we can't talk about it because there's that process.
There's a strange irony here, I think, in as much as the government is doing this for fear of people like Nigel Farage and elements in the Conservative Party then making a great hue and cry about public inquiries. That's quite an odd thing, isn't it? To see this sort of libertarian, agile, not politics as usual, right-wing politics screaming about the need for public inquiries. I mean, public inquiries are the opposite of what that sort of politics ought to want. They're a way, as you say very often, for the establishment to kick this stuff into the long grass. That's not a very Farage-ist demand.
No, but it's a very effective media strategy because you choose... And it's exactly how Farage used to fight the Brexit wars, right? You choose one thing that you can fixate on and you get everybody very het up about and you get the government to resist you for a while and then the government backs down and then you've secured that win, and then you go on to demand something else. Yeah. I mean, that is Farage's modus operandi.
What is actually going to be achieved by this inquiry, do you think? Speaking, as you just said, as an inquiry skeptic?
I am an inquiry skeptic, but I think there are things that do obviously need to be looked at. I thought where Keir Starmer was particularly convincing on Tuesday was two issues in particular. One is what's going on in the Prevent scheme. You know, Axel Rudi Cabana was referred to Prevent three times, but it was never escalated up to the top tier of intervention. Why not? Is that scheme working? Fair enough. Let's have a look at that. The second is, have we got the right definition of terrorism? Should we be classifying acts which don't have an obvious political motive as terrorism? There are important areas of the law and a public policy that do need looking at here. The problem is when you do it through a public inquiry, it can tend to get very sprawling and look into all sorts of different things and take years to actually report on anything. So, you know, we'll see. Maybe this will be quite a targeted intervention and just looking at one or two specific issues, in which case it could come up with some interesting conclusions.
There is something sort of unsettling and very interesting at the heart of all this about what was said at the time or in the immediate aftermath of those stabbings about the idea that there was a lot of sort of official obfuscation, that people weren't being told the whole story, right?
The police say it's a non-terror incident. I just wonder whether the truth is being withheld from us. I don't know the answer to that, but I think it is a fair and legitimate question.
The idea that this could be understood as a terrorist attack was sort of shoved to one side. And as it turns out, the government seems to think that now, right? And therefore you get into another conversation about whether in retrospect, in the minds of a lot of people, Nigel Farage was onto something. Chris Philp, the Shadow Home Secretary, is making quite similar noises on behalf of the Conservative Party as well, right? That almost that the government agreeing to this public inquiry and saying there is something to be examined here shows that the authorities did something wrong to start with. I think a lot of people will interpret this latest turn like that, won't they?
Yeah, I mean, look, the conspiracy accusation, which Nigel Farage has kind of been talking vaguely about and others as well, you know, when they talk about cover-up, the only convincing cover-up that I think that there could have been here was the idea that they didn't, you know, officials didn't call it an act of terror in those early days because they didn't want to fuel public disorder.
Which ironically caused lots of public disorder, arguably.
Well, exactly. If that was the aim, then it didn't work. There's a kind of more... well, potentially more convincing, depending on your view, explanation, which is that, you know, the explanation that Keir Starmer gave on Tuesday, which is we couldn't call it a terror offence because under British law, this is what counts as a terror offence. And we couldn't make the link between his actions and any actual political motivation or end that he was seeking. Maybe it was worth explaining to people that, you know, there were traces of ricin found or that there was an Al-Qaeda training manual. You know, obviously officials were very concerned in those early days that somehow people were going to get the idea that this was an Islamist terrorist, which he clearly wasn't. I'm always of the view that more information on these things is better. And I think we've got to find a way of being able to provide fuller information to try and douse out these conspiracy theories. But look, this is going to be something that happens again and again and again.
I was going to say that. There's a sort of awful familiarity about this. In as much as you've just said, the authorities necessarily have to be cautious and careful here. And yet the sort of right-wing politicians who constantly call them out are not in the business of care and caution, right?
Yeah, that is right. Your political enemies, I mean, maybe not so much in the Tory party, definitely Reform and definitely on the online far right, are just out to make mischief. And Keir Starmer has called them out on that a bit. But you've also got to recognise failings where they come. And I think the next few years is going to be a real test for politics in the West in general. How do you combat conspiracy when, A, there might be an element of truth in it, as you and I have just been discussing.
Exactly.
And B, people are not clustering around the same media that they used to and getting their news from very, very diverse and very difficult to track sources.
Okay, let's pause here for a minute. When we come back, we will chat to Kieran about the likely impact of Donald Trump's second term in office.
Wenn man Leute fragt, was macht einen Investor aus, bekommt man oft diese Antworten. Investoren sind reich. Sie tragen teure Anzüge und haben Designertaschen. Sie waren Einserschüler und sind Mathe-Genies. Interessant, aber das stimmt so nicht ganz. Man muss weder reich noch Experte sein, um zu investieren. Mit iShares ETFs kannst du in Hunderte und Tausende von Unternehmen mit nur einem einfachen Schritt investieren. Schon ab einem Euro. Finde iShares bei deinem Broker oder deiner Bank und fang noch heute an, mit ETFs zu sparen. Kapitalanlagerisiko. Marketinginformation.
Right, we all know what everybody is talking about, or has even a passing interest in politics. This week, as many predicted, almost immediately after being sworn in, Donald Trump signed a huge number of executive orders. There were far too many of these things in Donald Trump's slew of executive orders for us to go through them all. But our sister podcast, Today in Focus and Politics Weekly America this week, are covering more of them in depth. Kieran, let's talk through some of the standout policies symbolised by those executive orders. First of all, the thing that struck me straight away, the most obvious thing, was what he's going to do from February the 1st onwards, as I understand it, as regards tariffs. He said there will be 25% tariffs on goods coming into the USA from Canada and Mexico, and 10% tariffs on goods coming in from China. And obviously the threat is that if you get on the wrong side of him, as you said just before the break, you'll get whacked with tariffs as well. Tell me about the UK's sort of understanding of that and how much people in positions of power and influence are feeling nervous.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if there's one thing I think that this government wants from Donald Trump, it's not to get hit by tariffs. And we know already how vulnerable they are on the economy. Everything Rachel Reeves has done over the last kind of 48 hours has been about trying to get growth going. Pretty much the biggest hindrance on that growth would be really punitive tariffs from the US. Now, from what we're told, people in Whitehall are not expecting blanket tariffs like he's talking about levying on Canada and Mexico. Maybe he'll go after specific sectors, whether it's, you know, steel or cars or, you know, heavy industry, which would maybe be a bit of a win, but they're very, very worried. And if they can do anything to manage to exempt the UK, and there is some hope, I think, that the UK will be exempted, then they will be kind of pulling every lever, as Rachel Reeves likes to say, to make sure that happens.
Well, let's get into what that might actually mean. What, crawling so far up Trump's bum, you need a torch, politically speaking.
I'm sure they wouldn't put it like that. I think that it's trying to pick the right fights, basically.
Or pick no fights at all.
Well,
it sounds
I mean,
like.
they were asked earlier this week to respond to Donald Trump's comments on a range of issues, on things like pulling out of the Paris Climate Agreement or all of those executive orders that you were just talking about. And Downing Street absolutely would not go there, would not comment on it. And actually, that's probably going to be a sensible policy for the next few years, because if you comment on everything that Donald Trump does that you don't like, I mean, first of all, you wouldn't talk about anything else. Second of all, you're not really achieving much. So the best thing I think they can hope for is to try and neutralize a lot of other potentially difficult political issues and fight mainly on this one.
But this is a storyline we will surely see playing out all over the world. Donald Trump is very close here to running a sort of political protection racket, isn't he? Don't do anything to annoy me, or from a distance using America's economic might, I will smash up your economy.
That is pretty much what he was elected on a promise to do. You know, that is who you have in the White House. And one thing he probably can do is levy the tariffs that he wants. So what do? You're going to fight him? We don't have the economic power to do that.
You mentioned the Paris Accords a moment ago. Clearly, one of the big losers here is the climate emergency. Trump has served notice that he is withdrawing the US from the Paris Climate Agreement, reversing electric vehicle targets and introducing a barrage, it's fair to say, of pro-fossil fuel actions. How much more difficult, Kieran, do you think it is for countries like the UK to continue to justify climate measures in this new era which Trump has commenced? We both know that large chunks of the electorate are easily persuaded that climate action and net zero and so on are a bad idea. And there's the world's preeminent power saying, we'll just forget about it all then, right?
Yeah, although polling suggests that British opinion is quite different on this issue from American opinion. We are much more convinced that man-made climate change is a thing and that policymakers need to do something about it. I suspect what the response of the British government will be is to refocus all of their climate action, and already they've been doing this, and make it sound more like economic action, you know, pro-jobs moves rather than pro-climate moves. And the case they will make is, look, America's now, I mean, you're already seeing this, unraveling the massive green subsidies that Joe Biden put in place. Here's a chance for us to go and capture a whole load of international business that might otherwise have gone America's way.
Let's talk some more about Starmer and Trump and how they may or may not get on. Nigel Farage earlier this week, I think, talked about relations between the two of them being icy cold, for what that's worth. I mean, he would say that, wouldn't he?
Yeah.
Starmer is, as you said a moment ago, gives the appearance of someone frantically trying to find common ground that probably doesn't exist. First of all, where do you think they're going to try and sort of convey the idea that there is common ground? And then also, do you think we can expect them to publicly disagree on much and the UK to dissent from the Trump line from time to time?
On the first question, where are they going to try and find common ground? You know, I suspect they'll say, we also want to boost the economy and we're going to be a pro-business government, which they're looking slightly more like than they were a few months ago. Will they dissent from the Trump line? I think you're already starting to see very rarely. Let's see what happens if America does levy tariffs on some of our industry. First of all, rhetorically, does Keir Starmer stand up, as he has been doing, to be fair, and say, I don't think tariffs are a good idea. But second of all, in policy terms, do the Brits levy retaliatory tariffs on American goods? That's the discussion that's going on right now in Whitehall.
You've talked a lot about the sort of realpolitik of this, the idea that the British government just probably has to accept that Trump's there. Our economic and political and diplomatic relationship with the US is vital, and therefore somehow, and God knows how we do this, we have to make the best of it, right? But we both know that in the politics of the left in particular, as Trump goes into his second term and these things pile up, and presumably there are large swathes of what he does get uglier and uglier, there will be calls for a different sort of political leadership on Starmer's part. Ironically, a more sort of Trumpist kind of political leadership, or Trumpish, in as much as, you know, be who you are, say what you feel. If you're a politician to the centre-left, you should be loudly opposing some of this and saying that Trump is bad news in various ways. Those calls will grow.
Yeah, well, like Justin Trudeau did. I mean, you know,
look what happened to him.
Look what happened to him. I just don't think it buys you very much to be the anti-Trump voice on the world stage. And, you know, even Macron, who does it a bit, picks his moments. And I think you could probably, this is what Downing Street would say anyway, you pick your moments where you can be the anti-Trump voice, but you can't do it on everything.
But you don't think that just creates a moral vacuum? When one looks at politics from the outside, that Donald Trump is going to do absolutely heinous things and nobody in any position of power is going to say so.
Well, I mean, first of all, is Keir Starmer on the global stage really in a position of power?
No.
I don't feel that he is.
No, but he's the British Prime Minister. It's not insignificant.
Yeah, I think there are things that he will try and offer some moral leadership on, particularly, you know, things that he cares deeply about. Things like the rule of law, which he does care about, and he talks about the importance of institutions. He might say stuff like that. But again, you know, Britain adrift from the EU now no longer has the clout that it used to. What are you bringing to that conversation? Labour's main worry at the moment is, how do we get this economy going and how do we stay in power next time around to try and see through our 10-year plan?
Yeah.
Everything else is subsidiary to that. Maybe in a second term, he'll feel braver and more willing to posture on the world stage. But right now, that is not where Keir Starmer is.
Yeah, and they would say that the only people calling for him to make a great moral stance about Trumpism would be Guardian readers, and who cares about them? That's usually, really?
Only us, John, only us.
Let alone Guardian journalists. Now, Keir Starmer did not intend the inauguration. That, as we know, is the norm, just to make that clear. But there was a ragtag cast in and around the inauguration and all the associated hoopla of current and former British politicians there. If you were being cruel, you'd say it was like the Oscars for Wallys. Among the inauguration cast were Boris Johnson, Liz Truss, you know where I'm coming from here, Suella Braverman, Priti Patel, and of course, Farage. What's going on there, do you think? Is Trump's America now a sort of rehab facility for failed British right-wingers?
Well, look, the first thing I should point out is that these were not invitees of the White House or of Donald Trump himself.
Apart from Johnson.
So Boris Johnson was the only one in the rotunda. As far as we can tell, the others were all in, you know, other parts of the Capitol building.
Why do you think Truss, Braverman, Priti Patel all turned up on the fringes of it?
Because they feel that this is their moment. Their movement is in the ascendancy, and they feel like they're getting a bit of stardust being rubbed off on them.
Yeah,
it
right.
doesn't surprise me that Liz Truss and Nigel Farage were there. The interesting one for me is Priti Patel. And this is going to be a real theme, I think, of the next 4 years for the Conservative Party. Kemi Badenoch, in particular, her instincts, I think, are to get close to Trump and to Trumpism. And you really saw it in her first session of PMQs, where she stood up and kind of almost rubbed Labour's face in it. Ha ha, look, Trump got elected. Don't you all feel embarrassed now? It'll be interesting to see how well that resonates with the British public, where Trump is not at the moment popular. Maybe that will change.
We will come on to this in a few seconds.
But, you know, it might well backfire on the Tories trying to be Trump-lite. People may see that as not being very British.
Now, I have just been out on the road, anywhere but Westminster. The Guardian's on-off video series is soon returning. I was in Rugeley in Staffordshire, which is a former coal town where there used to be a big Amazon warehouse that recently closed down. It seemed like a good place to sort of be in the midst of Midwestern England to talk to people about Donald Trump and how they feel about him. There is this cliche around that British people instinctively don't really like Donald Trump, and they certainly don't like Elon Musk, right? But what that trip, which happened earlier this week, really reminded me was, you don't have to try very hard to find British people who are sort of reasonably sympathetic and quite like him and think he's doing some good things, mostly in the sense that they think Donald Trump puts America first and we ought to put Britain first, right? And a lot of people feel that quite powerfully. I was also struck with the fact that there were three sort of people who sounded favourable or sympathetic about Trump. One, you could say, sort of fitted stereotype in the sense that he was a middle-aged white man. Another fellow was a migrant worker from Turkey who was a Just Eat delivery driver who liked Trump. Mm. And then another person was a mum of about 30, who outwardly you wouldn't think of as a sort of stereotypical reform-leaning kind of populist voting sort of person. And yet she said, yeah, we need a bit of Britain first. We need some of that here. Trumpism has wafted and will waft even more over here because he's back in office, right? It gives license to that politics, I think, to spread even more. And therefore it's complacent to say it'll never happen here.
I think that is really interesting what you found there, John, because, you know, my view in talking to voters for the last few years has always been that Trump does not have a great appeal here. He's not Farage. You know, Farage taps into a deep-seated Englishness that I think Trump, with his bombastic persona, really grates with a lot of Brits.
No, but the idea that in this troubled, confused, conflicted world, you put your own country and your own people, in quote marks, whoever they are and however you characterise them, quite a nasty way very often, right? That's what it emphasises. And so it's not necessarily I want Donald Trump. It's like we should have our own version.
Well, and, you know, to a certain extent, maybe we already did. That's certainly how Donald Trump viewed it, because he thought of Boris Johnson as being
I agree.
The British
I think that's
version
true.
Of Donald Trump. That is fascinating. And that is exactly what Reform is hoping will happen. And your point there about the 30-year-old mum is really telling, because that's who Reform are basically going to target next. They're talking about, they will say openly, you know, we've already got the angry men on side, now we're going for the worried women. And so it's people exactly like that mum that they want to win over. And if they're already showing signs of being receptive to that message, then perhaps there's fertile ground for them.
Yeah, and Trump sort of being on telly anew is kind of very, very favourable mood music. Thank you for joining us, Kieran.
Thanks, John.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. If we've left you with any unanswered questions, I don't think we have, we never do, but if we have, you can now email us directly. So please do write to us with any thoughts or queries about today's episode or anything else you'd like us to discuss on the podcast. You can email us at politicsweeklyuk, all one word, at theguardian.com. And if you enjoyed this podcast, please do like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a glowing review. It really does make a difference. If you're interested in listening to more about the return of President Trump, tomorrow our sister podcast, Politics Weekly America, will be looking at how his first week back in the White House unfolded. Plus, the Today in Focus podcast will take you through the flurry of executive orders Trump signed and what they tell us about his priorities. This episode of Politics Weekly UK was produced by Frankie Toby. The music is by Axel Cacoutier, and the executive producers are Zoe Hitch and Nicole Jackson.
Hi there, Jonathan Friedland here, columnist at The Guardian and host of our Politics Weekly America podcast. I want to ask for your help. Guardian podcasts depend on the support of you, our listeners, to help fund coverage, especially in years like this one. We don't have a billionaire owner or shareholders holding the purse strings, which is how we stay independent. To support The Guardian, just click the link in the episode description. And once again, thank you.
This is The Guardian.
Eine neue Form der Effizienz mit Asana. Automatisieren Sie Workflows, damit Ihr Team in weniger Zeit mehr erreichen kann. Kostenlos testen unter asana.com.
Wie kann man Risiko im Leben reduzieren? Einen Helm tragen, fit bleiben und die Freunde meiden, die verrückte Ideen haben. Und beim Investieren? Hier sollte man diversifizieren. Wenn du in einen iShares ETF investierst, kaufst du in einem Schritt einen Teil von Hunderten oder Tausenden von Unternehmen. So musst du dir keine Sorgen mehr machen. Du kannst dir stattdessen lieber Gedanken darüber machen, wer die Fotos von der wilden Nacht mit deinen Freunden gemacht hat. Finde iShares bei deinem Broker oder deiner Bank und fange noch heute an, mit ETFs zu sparen. Kapitalanlagerisiko. Marketinginformation.